Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Well, there's been quite a wake-up call. It came recently from the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the gold standard federal exam. Math and reading performance among American 13-year-olds has hit the lowest level in decades, a downward trend that began years before the pandemic. Well, this week we're looking at this from several angles, beginning with a student perspective and that of a student who aspires to be a teacher. Frankfort High graduate Audrey Gilbert is on the board of the Kentucky Student Voice Team and is the national and state president of Educators Rising. It's designed to bring high school students back into those classrooms as teachers. Audrey Gilbert, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
And I'm told that you come from a long, long line of Eastern Kentucky teachers.
Yes. My mom was a teacher. My grandma was a teacher. My grandfather was a teacher and administrator. I have lots of aunts and uncles who were teachers. And my dad does school architecture. So lots of education from literally all different sides.
So growing up, was there just, it was just a given in your mind that you were going to become a teacher, or did you have other thoughts?
I've always wanted to be a teacher. I have a picture of me in kindergarten with my mom's school bag, wearing her jewelry on career day, wanting to be a teacher. Over the years, I had many people, including some principals, tell me that I should not do that. I've had some family members tell me I should not do that, that I'm going to be underpaid, overworked, those things. But I've always wanted to go back to it, always thought about teaching, always wanting to make an impact on other kids.
Would you say this, that sometimes it's not the paycheck, it's the thing that you're doing? Is that what drives you?
Yes, and I think that's true for all teachers. The reason that we still have teachers in the classroom, even though they're underpaid, is because they have a joy in what they're doing. And if you have a joy in teaching, you'll keep doing it through as many obstacles as you can handle.
Do you feel that maybe society has kind of taken advantage of that?
I think so. I think that because everybody has to be taught and everybody has to go to school, we just think of teachers as always there. We don't consider the fact that they're people too. We don't think about they could walk out the next day and go do something else. Your degree puts you in a place where you're valuable everywhere. So the lack of respect and generally taking advantage of teachers has happened, especially over my time in the K-12 system. I've seen it change from when I was in kindergarten, first grade, working with my mom and her fellow teachers, to now when I've graduated high school. There's just the difference in how we treat teachers.
Well, Audrey, you were brought to our attention by Rachel Bellin at the Kentucky Student Voice Team, where you're a board member, and you've helped design and implement the team's strategies around improving student climate and culture. And I wondered if you could tell us a little more about that work and why you've gone so deeply into school climate in particular.
With our work, we look at all elements of the school. We look at the physical climate of the school. Recently, we did a study and students actually commented on the temperature of the school. But we look at safety. We look at social and emotional safety along with physical. We look at learning experiences in the school to see how engaged students are and to better understand how they're interacting with their teachers and their peers. I was able to, as a freshman, get into this work and see how other students were thinking in other parts of the state, to really recognize both the uniqueness in the student experience, but also the common threads that put us all together, because I was experiencing some of the same frustrations in my school as a student all the way across the state in Western Kentucky was.
Have you been able to take the information that you gained from that work to school administrators and suggest change?
Yes. So in several of the schools that we've worked with, most notably Marshall County, the students that we've worked with and trained, we give them that information. We train them on how to share that back. And they've taken that back to look at things like dress code policies. That's a very popular one to make them more equitable. And in Marshall County, they did take that back. They've presented to their staff, they've presented to their faculty and administration, and they looked at those things to really get a better understanding and suggest new policy changes.
Do you think we adults really need to be a lot more willing to offer students a seat at the decision and at the policymaking table?
Yes, I think that students are really taken advantage of in survey settings, particularly. A lot of the time, something is informed by, oh, well, we have a survey that says this many students feel this way, but you don't actually know how the student feels. So really bringing students in, talking to students with different experiences, and asking them to contribute to the policy to make it what they need it to be is really valuable. And I've seen that through various experiences, both one-on-one with policy, but in group settings as well. Students might not know the lingo that we use in education, but they know what needs to happen, and they know how it feels to be in a classroom where they don't feel comfortable or respected, or they don't feel like they're learning. So they really need to be at the center of those conversations.
I know that you've been heading up a KSVT initiative that focuses on measurement, assessment, and accountability in education. Tell us more about that, what you found.
I worked both with a team in Kentucky where we did specifically Kentucky-related research, and then we did work with the National Urban League around assessment and accountability. But with this, we really heard from students that they want to be measured more than what they can do on a bubble test. They want that project-based learning that's happening in some classrooms and that's growing slowly across the state. They want the experiences where they feel valued as more than a number, where they feel valued as a person, where they can express some of their humanity more than they can just say, yes, this is what I heard in class and this is how I'm going to repeat it. So really being able to employ those skills of critical thinking and expression, students found that those were the experiences in their classrooms when they felt like they were learning and they enjoyed it the most. But really, when they're doing things like taking those bubble tests or sitting there and timed writing without being able to express themselves in any way, it took away from the educational experience and made them really dislike school more.
How are those conditions that I talked about in the introduction, the divisiveness that we're experiencing in this country, how's that affecting interest among your peers in becoming teachers?
I think that when the conversation happens a lot about teacher pay and about workload and focuses on the negative things in those conversations, that's all that you're going to hear. If you don't come from a family of educators, generally you're not hearing the positive things. You're not seeing those day-to-day experiences on the other half of the classroom. You're not understanding the joys of teaching. I will say I've had several friends who would make great teachers. They are passionate about various subjects. They're good at talking to other people and helping them understand things and work through problems. But I say, you know, you should really consider teaching. They look at me, they laugh a little bit and say, I want to be paid. I want to be paid for my work. I want to be able to receive fair compensation. I talked to a fifth grader recently she reminds me of myself when I was in fifth grade. She would make an excellent teacher. She said, no, my parents said that's absolutely not something I should do. I'm not paid. But then we talk to them about meaningful people in their lives, and they talk about teachers, and they say, Miss So-and-so had an excellent impression on me. She changed my life for the better. So really just hearing those conversations about all the negative aspects of teaching and that being the dominant conversation, instead of seeing what's happening inside the classrooms and the impact that teachers have on students and vice versa, that's impacted negatively a lot.
We had something happen a few years ago that really changed things, and I'm talking about the pandemic. And knock on wood, it seems as though we're past that. But it really scrambled the learning process and the teaching process. And that was for a couple of precious years for many young people, for you and your peers. The Kentucky Student Voice team did a statewide Coping with COVID student survey. What'd you learn from that?
I learned about the importance of being together. When I was doing virtual learning at my house, I had my brothers there. They're about 2 years younger than I am. So I still had that community sense in my house because I had peers to talk to. A lot of my friends didn't have that. And really being able to understand what it means to be together and to learn together, it was powerful. I worked specifically with mental health related questions, and seeing just the dive that took, students weren't able to talk to their teachers. They weren't able to talk to friends to access resources. And depending on your background, sometimes the school is the only place where you have those kinds of resources and can have difficult conversations about your mental health. So not being able to access those things, not being able to experience school in its fullest, really hit students hard. It made things a whole lot more difficult, but really being able to see that they had some freedom over their learning during COVID, because everybody was figuring it out at the same time, there was a little bit more room for creativity. So some of the learning experiences that were happening, some of the different ways, the innovative ways that people were able to do things, because there wasn't the pressure of the test because of our waiver, that did help students some, but really that mental health aspect was overwhelmingly negative.
Let's talk about mental health for a moment. We do hear quite a bit about very serious concerns about the impact on mental health. What do you know from your experience?
We talk about the negative impact on student mental health. And when you talk to teenagers, it is mostly true. You can sit down with them, talk about mental health with them, and you'll hear all kinds of things that you never would have expected to hear out of a 15-year-old. But when you use resources that are available in your schools and you build on that community sense to be able to talk to other people and to make sure that students know that it's okay not to be okay, that sounds cliche, but that really has been a really important thing for us to tell other students. I've had some friends that we worked on mental health projects together at school, and we talked to the counselors about what resources were available. And just being able to have that information out there and to talk to people about, you know what, you don't have to be happy all the time. Things are difficult right now. Things will be difficult in the future, but you can handle those things and we can help you with those things. The change in how students look at things when you make that available to them really shows you how important it is to keep mentioning those things and to make sure that those communications are always there.
Well, if I may ask you to give us kind of a sense of that, what did you hear from a 15-year-old that you would never expect to hear?
The lack of hope that a lot of students have. A lot of people, when they associate student mental health, they think social media. Social media is rotting our brains or something like that. But just the lack of hope. Students will sit there, especially during COVID, and think, there's no point for me to keep going. There's nothing that I'm gaining out of this. I don't have school to go to tomorrow to see my friends. I can't go out and do this. There's not a next step for me, especially students that don't see a clear path for their futures. It's not something that they can envision, so why should they keep working towards it? So really that lack of hope. I've seen that a lot through the Coping with COVID study, but also in just conversations after the pandemic. Seeing students who are still struggling from bouncing back and forth and being thrown into these situations and those situations. They just don't have that hope because they can't see that path forward and they don't feel like they have any control over that path forward.
Well, as a society, we were already struggling with the presence and the influences of the internet, social media, smart devices, and now comes along generative AI. I just wonder if you have concerns and on the flip side of that, if you see advantages.
I will say I'm a big fan of AI, of ChatGPT. I find that it is very helpful. One of the teachers at my school did an AI flash fiction challenge with her class. So really flipping that conversation from all the negative things, the potentially negative things that are happening with AI or could happen. A lot of people think, oh, students are going to cheat on this or that and find their way around this assignment or that assignment. Students are doing that anyways. AI is not going to change that. It's been happening since the beginning of school. We're not paying somebody else to write our papers anymore, so at least there's that. But you can tell when it's a ChatGPT written paper. I can tell when it's a ChatGPT written paper. But being able to have kind of a hands-on experience with some device that you can bounce ideas off of. I've seen that work in the professional world. I've been able to use it myself just to generate ideas, to think maybe these two things don't go together. Maybe these should be separate articles or these should be separate interest issues. But I think there's potential for it to be positive, depending on the light that we put on it. If teachers say, absolutely not, I hate AI, we're not using that in my classroom, kids are naturally going to want to use it. But if you embrace it and you say, you know what, this is something that we don't really know about, so let's figure it out together. Let's see what we can do with it. Then you're starting to build that positive learning around it. So it's not necessarily something that's going to be used as a tool of destruction as much as it can be used for a tool for learning.
Wow. Well, you're heading to Bellarmine this fall to become a classroom teacher yourself. And given that you could choose anything in your future, including far more lucrative paths, why are you determined to become a teacher?
Because I come from a family of educators and I'm friends with a lot of former educators. I still go out and eat dinner with my kindergarten teacher and I will be this Thursday. I see the lifelong impact of helping other people. There's a lot of other careers where you can help other people, of course, but being able to shape young people when they might not have anything else. They're forced to be in your classroom, so you might as well make it fun. You might as well make that experience good for them. Being able to take those experiences and make them something meaningful more than it is something that they just have to do. But I plan to become a middle school teacher, and when I tell people that, I get a lot of confused looks because middle school is a rough time. And I had a rough time in middle school, but I like to tell people that I can go back and make that better for someone else. So always wanting to improve on things like that. So teaching has always been at that center. It's always been something that's called me back because I know the impact that I can have on other people because of the impact teachers have had on me.
Audrey Gilbert with the Kentucky Student Voice Team. She's off to Bellarmine this fall. She just graduated from Frankfort High School, and she has plans to be part of the next generation of classroom teachers in this country. Thank you so much, Audrey.
Thank you.
Back in a moment with teaching durable skills and something called transformative learning. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU host Brian Burkhart with coming events and arts opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. In Carter County, selected musicians from the Louisville Orchestra will perform at 3 p.m. July 8th at the Olive Hill Center for the Arts and Education. This performance is part of the Louisville Orchestra's In Harmony Tour across Kentucky. For more information, visit ohcae.org. Kentucky writers take note, South Arts is accepting applications for the inaugural Southern Prize and State Fellowships for Literary Arts. This recognition program supports, acknowledges, and celebrates writers in South Arts' 9-state region with $80,000 in awards. The genre for the 2024 cycle is fiction. Deadline is August 4th. For information and to apply, visit southarts.org. For information on how to support these and other arts events in Kentucky, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. I'm Brian Burkhart. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Earlier in the hour, we heard from future classroom teacher Audrey Gilbert about student perceptions of school and learning and about changes they would like to see. Bridget Blom, host of our ongoing series on education, has a focus on those essential skills that can't be learned from a textbook.
As a nation, we have long tracked educational outcomes through traditional measures like reading, science, and math scores. But there's growing recognition that these scores alone don't adequately prepare students for the demands of college and the job market. Enter durable skills, skills that set students up for post-high school success. These competencies include things like problem solving, critical thinking, goal setting, and collaboration, abilities that research shows are highly valued by employers in today's rapidly evolving economy. Tim Taylor is the co-founder and president of America Succeeds. Under Tim's leadership, America Succeeds works to equip students with the necessary skills to thrive in the global economy while making meaningful contributions to their local communities. Tim, welcome to Eastern Standard.
And Bridget, thanks so much. It's great to be on with you.
Excellent. Thank you. Your work with America Succeeds has led to some groundbreaking research for the education and business community. We will dig into that data in a minute. But first, I want to take a step back and hear from you what exactly the distinction is between durable skills and traditional academic learning.
Yeah. So through a lot of the work that we've been doing, we've continued to hear from employers. I think everybody was probably familiar with an employer saying, just give me somebody who can think critically or collaborate and I'll teach them what they need to know. And that's the root of durable skills. Durable skills are how you use what you know, critical thinking, collaboration, communication, creativity, and then how you show up in the world, which is things like metacognition and leadership and a growth mindset. And often they've been called soft skills. Some people refer to them as 21st century skills. We make the distinction in as to durable skills, primarily for employers who recognize that these are skills that you take with you from job to job. They last a lifetime and they power entire careers. So those durable skills are slightly different, and they're one half of sort of what makes up a whole person when they show up to for a job. which is the combination of technical skills and these durable skills that launch careers.
So nationwide in the research that you've done, you found that over 50 million job postings demand at least one durable skill. In Kentucky, you found that 77% of job postings required at least one durable skill. What implications does this have for teaching and how the state tracks success in education?
Yeah, our research has demonstrated that these skills are in demand across every industry, across all geographies, and regardless of education attainment level. The opportunity and the real challenge is how we begin to embed and teach these skills during a K-12 experience. And it's something that the education system just doesn't have a lot of experience doing. And so we're working with teachers and educators and folks in the education system to try to identify how you would make sure that this is part of an everyday curriculum for reading and math and science. It's really part of every subject as opposed to being standalone classes. The worst way to go about doing this would be to try and create a critical thinking course that you would do for 50 minutes and then move on to your next course during the day. What we have to make sure is that kids can move effortlessly through and demonstrate these skills while they're doing the other things that they would do in a job day to day. So they're just part and parcel of how you approach things. And that's really what the opportunity is and what a lot of the work that we're doing with partners around the country looks like is to figure out how to work with students and teachers and create professional development opportunities to make sure that kids have access to these skills, learning these skills, and they also have the vocabulary to be able to say, here's what it looks like the last time I collaborated, to be able to use those terms and also highlight how they implement those skills in their daily lives.
In a teaching and learning environment, you want to see the development of these skills fully embedded in the teaching and learning of reading, the teaching and learning of mathematics. To your point, it's not something standalone. It's about the approach to the learning environment that allows students to develop these skills while they're going through school.
Yeah, spot on. And I think, I'd be remiss if I didn't say the reading and writing and arithmetic are table stakes. We are not saying that those skills are not important. Those are absolutely necessary. We need to do a better job making sure that everybody is getting great quality instruction and strong outcomes in those areas. But at the same time, you can learn to collaborate or learn to think critically. And we've had teachers who have shared with us examples of a math teacher who said, when I'm teaching math, whether I'm teaching fractions in the early grades or geometry or even up to trigonometry, if I have a group of students work together to solve a handful of problems and ask them, come up with different ways to solve these problems. And then what I want you to do is go to the blackboard and present to the class the way you thought through your solutions. The math teacher then said, I'm now having the kids collaborate and think critically and problem solve and practice communication skills, all while I am teaching my standard math curriculum. And I think that's the best example that we have heard of really innovative ways to embed these things in the classroom without disrupting or without changing the curriculum at all.
So, Tim, let's take it a step further. And if I'm a parent or a student, how do I know I'm developing these skills? What evidence do I have to provide as I move into college or into the workforce that I've developed these skills?
Yeah, it's first and foremost being really intentional about these skills. So I know for my own kids, when they were going through school, they were doing a lot of group work. I think that if you asked most kids while they're doing group work, what they're getting out of it or what they're learning, they might tell you that somebody in the group isn't pulling their own weight or some other sort of missing sort of the intentionality behind what that is. And even the fact that that group work is considered collaboration. So making sure that when they're practicing these skills, they're hearing the terms of what those skills are and why those skills are important. And again, what they will take with them, even in the early days of this, because there's no real assessment. We can dig into assessments in a little bit, but even the self-evaluation and recognizing that I know what these terms mean, and I have confidence in my ability to demonstrate that I have these skills. And I should mention also, as folks may be hearing about this, These are skills we practice our entire lives. We are not expecting anybody in their K-12 experience to master any of these skills. I'm not sure that there is such a thing as mastery of these skills. And everybody has strengths and weaknesses related to these skills. So students being able to identify what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, things they need to work on, but also what they can lead with when they are talking about themselves or when we're advertising ourselves for a job, being able to give examples of where you have used these skills, how you've used them, and the terminology that goes along with them.
So there's a clear competitive advantage for a student to be able to say they've developed these skills coupled with the content mastery that they develop through education. Are there competitive advantages also for states? And are there states that you see making real headway in the development of durable skills as part of their approach to education?
Yeah, boy, that's a great question. So yes, right? The World Economic Forum, so our research, the 80 million plus job descriptions that we looked at, as you said, have 7 of the 10 most in-demand skills are these durable skills. The World Economic Forum just released a report, and they say that 9 of the top 10 most in-demand skills are these durable skills. So when they're this much in demand, and we know that this is how folks will be able to succeed as the workforce changes over time, and these durable skills don't change, the real opportunity is for an individual to learn these skills and demonstrate these skills, but also for states and all kinds of employers. I mean, the states are major employers, to be able to identify folks who have these skills. It's interesting, 10 states have just announced that they're moving away from a 4-year degree requirement for many of their states' jobs. I'd love to think that this is to provide greater equity and access and economic mobility for folks in those states. I think largely it's because of tightening workforce and there's not enough college graduates. We have a declining college going rate by about 10% since the pandemic. So folks are looking for different ways to get into and demonstrate their skills to be successful in the workforce. And if you don't have a 4-year degree, demonstrating some combination of technical skills and durable skills is a great way to be able to demonstrate what you're able to know and do and get into the workforce. And states are moving in that direction. And I think part of what they have to solve for is the technical skills, evaluating technical skills, but also these durable skills at the same time. And that's one of the challenges that all states face.
And so the states that get ahead of the curve on this issue will clearly have a competitive advantage in a modern economy. So let's hope from here in Kentucky, Kentucky is one of those. And with that in mind, what role do policymakers have to play in strengthening the collaboration between education and business communities to ensure a richer vision for education that prepares students for success?
Yeah, I think you nailed it in that question, right? I think the purpose of education has changed. It's been the same for a really long time, the maximization of knowledge. Now we have just all the knowledge in the world at our fingertips. I mean, literally in our pockets. And so it is actually how to distinguish good information from bad, how to collaborate. It's these human skills that go along with it. Again, reading, writing, arithmetic, table stakes. But it's the durable skills that are the real differentiators as we look at this. And so I think that as states look to make policies that are going to advance this and make sure that students have this, one of the things we're really bullish on are college and career readiness standards that embrace these skills. And a number of states are working on portraits of a graduate where the community comes together and says, this is what somebody should be able to know and do and look like at the end of their high school experience. Now, there are a number of states that have really robust portraits of a graduate with a number of these durable skills built into that portrait. Unfortunately, most will also admit that nothing is happening in the K-12 experience that would make somebody look like that portrait. So the policy is ahead of the practice in this case. But I think that if we can continue to have good tools and resources and we're really focused on this, that is an amazing first step of saying this is what somebody should be able to know or do, and then building that education system around delivering those skills so somebody actually looks like that portrait.
And so bringing the policy and the practice together would lead us to ensuring a meaningful diploma for young people as they enter into today's economy and the economy of the future. Tim, what's next on the durable skills front? Are there new reports in the works or new trends that we here in Kentucky should watch?
Yeah, I think that what's interesting is when we started this work a couple of years ago, this you didn't see much of this in the news. And I think for just with paying a little bit of attention, you can see the swell continuing to build. Skills-based hiring, another buzzword around sort of what's happening here. And I think so the next wave of this is around evaluation of these durable skills. Some people say they're impossible to teach. We fundamentally disagree with that. I think you can absolutely learn these skills. And then I also believe that you can assess these skills. In fact, every employer assesses these skills. Sometimes they'll do it in a job interview. Sometimes they'll hire folks, give them a chance on the job, and quickly fire them if they don't have these skills. In fact, one of the stats is that if you're between the ages of 18 and 24, the number one reason why you'll lose a job is because of lack of durable skills, not a lack of technical skills. And so I think that if there's a way that we can have kids find their strengths and know their strengths and demonstrate their strengths on the front end of the employment process and practice and learn and develop the skills they're not as good at, that's going to give them a leg up. And if employers can somehow assess those skills on the back end, they're going to save themselves a lot of expense and a lot of time by being able to match the individual's strengths to the job strength or to the characteristics that they're looking for in a particular role or career.
This is a critically important issue and so timely as we come out of the pandemic and watch education improvement as well as economic development. Tim, thank you so much for being with us today. Tim Taylor, the co-founder and president of America Succeeds, thank you for joining us on Eastern Standard.
Thanks, Bridget. We look forward to continuing to work with you on this subject.
Bridget Blom is president and CEO of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence. Transformative learning is another approach to unlocking the powers and potential of the human mind. We heard about it in an interview last summer by former Education Series host Cynthia Reeser with Nicola Mason, professor and chair in the Department of Teaching, Learning, and Educational Leadership here at EKU.
Transformative learning was a theory that first emerged in the 70s, and it was originally conceived for adult learners. But it's very relevant to the K-12 and college classroom and to our daily lives as well. So Dr. Mason, explain to us exactly what is transformative learning.
Well, let me just tell you, I first stumbled upon transformative learning as an approach to learning because I was trying to put a label on these experiences that my students were having in my classes every single semester. So transformative learning is exactly what it sounds like. It's an approach to teaching that facilitates a transformation in the way that we perceive things, the way we feel about things, and then in the actions that we take because of this transformation. So Dr. John Mesereau developed the framework of transformative learning during a study with adult women who were returning to school after a period away from education. He wanted to find out what factors hindered or helped their learning. So there are various stages in transformative learning, but I think the most important components that I'd like to share with you is the critical reflection and critical discourse. Transformative learning has influenced a variety of teaching and learning approaches. And for those that are clued up on educational approaches, it's very much aligned with constructivist education. And Mesereau believed that people can change their points of view by trying on another's point of view, and that by learning new frames of reference, one could transform habits of mind.
Help us imagine what this looks like and give us some examples from your classroom.
I teach a class called Exploring Africa Through Play. It's a class that I developed several years ago based on my original research. It's a general education elective course, so any student from any major can take this class. And what we do is we explore the diversity of Africa through the lens of children's songs and games. The premise of the course was out of my frustration with a lot of my students stereotyping Africa. I was shocked how many students think that Africa is a single country, that it's still very primitive in nature, or that everyone in Africa has dark skin. Of course, this is based on my own experiences being a South African American immigrant and having students be very surprised when they hear that I was educated and grew up in South Africa, but that I have light skin. Africa is a really diverse continent with 54 different countries, each as unique as the next. We spend a lot of class time sitting in circles playing different games in different languages, using materials that are unique to different geographical regions. There are over 2,000 African languages spoken on the continent. We use different complex rhythms, but we're essentially looking at the diversity of Africa through this lens of children's songs and games. While we do this, we reflect on the origins of our own Western games based on the historical use of traditional African games. So, for example, there's a game called Cheche Kule. It's an East African game, and it's a simple call and response. So there's a leader, and they call something, and then the group responds, usually with an exact imitation. But it's strikingly similar to head, shoulders, knees, and toes. Now, I don't know which one came first, the chicken or the egg, but we do know that eastern parts of Africa are known as the cradle of humanity because of the oldest human remains have been found there. And we also know that some of the oldest board games, like Mancala, have their roots in East Africa. So this critical analysis and reflection helps to broaden students' views of Africa from perhaps maybe the primitive idea that they have to a far more complex and influential culture that is the African continent. While we're doing this reflection, students usually gravitate to a much deeper critical thinking that explores their own personal misconceptions of Africa. And we address a lot of those stereotypes, but more importantly, we address the questions of why, underlining influences that have led us to those stereotypes. So my goal with this class especially is to create a new frame of reference about Africa because we've challenged students' assumptions and beliefs through critical reflection and dialogue. And that's really the primary principle of a transformative learning.
So it sounds like your students come in with one conception and they transform and have a much deeper and more nuanced understanding at the end of the class. So that's transformative learning, right?
That's it, in a nutshell, pretty straightforward, yeah.
And what was your other example?
So I have another example from my culturally responsive perspectives class. This is a class required by all our elementary and middle grades education majors. So those that want to teach kindergarten through fifth grade or fifth grade through ninth grade. And I really refer to this as the light bulb moment class. One of the many topics that we discuss in this class is privilege and the opportunities afforded to those with various types of privileges. Now, privilege is a heavy topic, so we start small and we discuss everyday privileges like right-handedness. Dr. Risa, are you left or right-handed?
I'm right-handed.
Right. So you represent 90% of the world's population because only 10% of the world's population is left-handed. But I don't know if you've realized most everyday items are designed for right-handed people. So if I think about musical instruments, for example, guitars, sports equipment like golf clubs, everyday items like scissors, even cultural practices or social practices like shaking hands are really focused on right-handed people. When we open this discussion up in class, it's quite illuminating to right-handed students when they hear what left-handed students have to go through on a daily basis to adapt their left-handed predominance in a right-handed world, essentially. And then we dig a little deeper into privilege as well. We talk about gender privileges. So those privileges afforded to males or females in different countries. And we talk about ethnic and racial privileges as well. Many of our students, and I'd say many adults, have never really thought about the privileges that they are afforded on a daily basis. And that really is the definition of privilege. If you don't have to think about it, it's a privilege. But the purpose of this activity in class is really self-examination and reflection. It's not to shame anyone, because it's not our fault that we have privilege. We didn't ask for any of these privileges. I didn't ask to be right-handed. But what we want students to do is reflect on what they intend to do with their privilege once they recognize they have it. Recognizing various privileges allows us to view the world in a different way, and we stop making assumptions about others. And because we're preparing future educators, we recognize different privileges and how that can help us be a better teacher.
Of course, a lot of our listeners aren't students, or they're not teachers, or they're not public educators. So how can we make that jump and apply transformative learning to our everyday, regular, daily lives?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because it reminded me of a story that you told me recently. Do you want to share that story with us?
I did. When I was a child in the 70s, I went shopping with my grandmother, and we went to what was sort of a ritzy furniture store in a nearby town, and she asked to see the bedroom set. She wanted to buy a new bedroom set, and the salesman made an assumption, and I've never been quite sure what he based it on, but he took her to the very back, to the very cheapest part, sort of the bargain bin. And she was so insulted by that because, she had the money. She was going to pay the man cash, that we left that store. And that made such an impression on me. I think we could describe it as a transformative experience, because it dawned on me for the first time how people judge us on our appearance, or something about her dialect, something about the way she looked made that person assume something about her that was completely wrong.
Right, exactly. And so that self-reflection is such a key part of transformative learning. And then I'd venture to say the next step was putting that reflection into action, and how that impacted the way you interact with other people, perhaps.
And I like to think so. I like to think that I'd, as they say, don't judge a book by its cover. But, we all fall into that trap sometimes. We all misjudge or assume things that aren't the case.
Exactly.
Can you think of any examples that you've witnessed, or examples maybe that your students have shared that have been just really insightful about how it can work in our daily life?
Yeah, I had a student a few years ago that brought a poem to class. They had to do exactly that. They had to bring an example of something that changed their point of reference or changed their point of view. And there's a poem by Joshua Dickinson. It's called "'Cause I Ain't Got a Pencil." And if you don't mind, I might read it to you. It's just a short poem.
Yes.
I woke myself up because we ain't got an alarm clock. Dug in the dirty clothes basket because ain't nobody washed my uniform. Brushed my hair and teeth in the dark because the lights ain't on. Even got my baby sister ready because my mama wasn't home. Got us both to school on time to eat us a good breakfast. Then, when I got to class, the teacher fussed because I ain't got a pencil. I can visibly see the paradigm shift that happens with students when they read this poem, and we've been reading it every semester since. And it really aligns with what Ms. Rowe stated, that transformative learning is when a new frame of reference transforms our habits of mind. And it really gets my students thinking about their own students and the situations that brought them to their classes every day, and some of the challenges that they have just to make it to class every single day to learn.
Hopefully, people can think about those assumptions and apply that idea, this educational theory of transformative learning, in the way they see others. Thank you so much for being with us today. This has been Dr. Nicola Mason, the chair of the Department of Teaching, Learning, and Educational Leadership at EKU. So thanks so much for sharing with us.
Thank you.
The more you know.
Finally, getting that degree may be about career and earning power, but it can also open doors to enriching life experiences. South Arts, the Atlanta-based nonprofit regional arts organization, has announced its 7th annual State Fellowships, awarded to one artist in each of the 9 states in South Arts region: Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Kentucky. Rachel Moser was among them. Rachel is an assistant professor of digital media and graphic design here at Eastern Kentucky University, and she's an artist. She uses natural and manufactured materials to present through sculpture, video, installation, and sound,
an ongoing study of climate change and human impact on the planet. You might have spotted Rachel's works at Transy's Moreland Gallery or maybe at Georgetown College, over at the Lexington Art League or the Parachute Factory. Rachel, thanks for joining us and congratulations on that fellowship.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So we're on the radio, so no visual, but we don't let that stop us. We have words and we have mental imagery to work with here. So first, if you could, can you describe for us generally what you're communicating through your work?
Yeah. So in my work, I like to explore the ideas of nature and its transformation over time. So I'm really interested in the concept of the world, both natural and manufactured, being in constant flux, often because of one another. So a big part of my practice is actually going to specific places and picking up different elements and creating site-specific installations and sculptures out of materials that I find on site. A big part of it is exploring place.
Well, your artist statement tells us that your work often begins with field exercises, including some pretty remote locations involving rivers, oceans, forests, and ice fields. And it's that last one to very near the North Pole in 2019 for the Arctic Circle Residency Program on a grant from the Great Meadows Foundation from Louisville that became the foundation for your current exhibition. Tell us, first of all, about that experience, because that sounds pretty incredible.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it was such a huge opportunity for me. It was my first residency that I've ever applied to, and I was lucky enough to get. I feel extremely lucky. So for my work personally, it's really hard for me to propose an idea of what it is that I'm going to do until I actually get to the space or the place. But for this residency, I did propose an idea of creating these site-specific installations. So for my current work, which is called Where It Used to Be Blue, which it's about the Arctic landscape. And the work was a result of this. So while I was on the residency in Svalbard, I made these sculptures that were out of ice that I just sort of picked up and placed horizontally. And then I 3D scanned them. And I also video and photo documented the work and also created some sound. I also documented the sound, which ultimately became a part of my installation when I got back to Lexington. I also was picking up pieces of trash that were sort of riddled on the Arctic beaches that I wasn't really sure what I was going to do with until I got back to Lexington and had some time to sort of reflect and think about my time there.
While you were there, you got to spend some time on an actual tall ship. And I've seen photographs of it. We're talking about a traditionally rigged tall ship with international artists, with scientists, architects, educators. Those must have been some pretty interesting dinnertime conversations aboard that ship.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. We were super lucky. We had a geologist on board. And then in Svalbard, they have people who are trained, who are our guides, and they were all really knowledgeable about what was happening as far as global warming and what it was that we were looking at with the moraines that were basically all this soot and debris that were eroding the glaciers. And so they were all really knowledgeable and had background and understanding of what it was that we were looking at. So it made it easier for visual artists who don't necessarily have a science background, but to give us some context about what it is we are seeing. So it was super special. I still pinch myself. I can't believe I had the opportunity to go there.
Well, I'd like to shift directions here if I could. And as I mentioned, you teach digital media and graphic design here at EKU. Two words, artificial intelligence. What do you make of it?
Okay. Do you want me to say two words or you're just saying the two words?
I'm just saying the two words and wondering what you think.
I was going to say freaky and exciting. But yeah, so I think it's kind of important to remember that AI is a tool. You know, it's been created by humans and it relies on data that it's been trained on. You know, so it doesn't have these emotions or subjective experiences that humans do. I do think AI is a powerful tool for the creation of, you know, digital media or digital art. But, you know, ultimately, I don't think it's going to replace creativity and imagination and, you know, unique human perspectives. At least I hope not.
Can you see yourself using AI in your art in some form?
I haven't yet, but I'm not against it. You know, at Eastern Kentucky, we are actually talking about developing a course to use it in some way. We're still sort of brainstorming about what that's going to look like. And I don't really know what it will look like either, but I think it's exciting. And I think it's important, especially being a digital media teacher. I think it's important to embrace it because I don't think it's, you know, I don't know if it's going to be going anywhere. I think it's just something that's another tool in our toolbox, just like, you know, video editing and photo editing. This is just going to be another tool that digital media artists are going to be using, I think.
Yeah, I think it's here to stay. Mm-hmm. your current work, where it used to be blue, where can that be seen?
It's actually not up now, but it will be up through the South Arts Fellowship. So me, along with 9 other artists from the South, are going to be touring in the South starting in August. And our first show is going to be at the Orr O'Keeffe Museum of Art, which is in Atlanta, which I know is far from Eastern Kentucky, but that's where at least a part of where it used to be blue will be. It's just a small part of it. So it wouldn't be the full installation, but it'll be a few pieces.
And it's also on your website, correct?
Yes, it is. Thank you. It is on my website and it's also on my social media. I have an Instagram and also my website, which is RJW Mosier. That's my handle, or rjwmosier.com.
And so what are you doing now? What's next?
I'm currently working on a new piece of work, I guess a new body of work that's actually going to be a collaboration with my good friend and fellow artist who's based in Lexington, Marco Lodgson. And it's called Residues of Concern. And we're sort of in the beginning stages of it, but ultimately it will be an installation that's depicting the history of an imagined landfill. That's TBD. That will be sometime next year.
All right, that's Rachel Mosier, Assistant Professor of Digital Media and Graphic Design here at Eastern Kentucky University, just awarded a South Arts Fellowship in support of her work as an installation artist. Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Crystal Jones, general assignment reporter, Chris Begley, special topics reporter, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, partners, and more, and you can sign up there for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard online at weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.